Morning. I am pleased to convene the Senate Subcommittee on Surface Transportation and Merchant Marine Infrastructure Safety and Security for today's hearing entitled How the Internet of Things Can Bring U.S. Transportation and Infrastructure into the 21st Century. This hearing will examine how the Internet of Things can advance our nation's transportation and infrastructure system. America's transportation network is well positioned to benefit from new developments in technology. For example, the Internet of Things offers new ways to help alleviate congestion on our nation's roads, reduce cargo shipping delays at ports, and monitor rail and pipeline infrastructure safety. This growing interconnected network can inform policymakers on where to invest limited resources in road and bridge maintenance. In March, Senator Booker and I joined Senators Ayotte and Schatz to introduce the Developing Innovation and Growing the Internet of Things, or the DIGIT Act. And this bipartisan legislation builds on our resolution, which passed the Senate last year. It calls for a nationwide strategy to drive development of the Internet of Things. The DIGIT Act would convene a working group of private and public sector stakeholders to offer recommendations to Congress. They would focus on how to plan for and encourage the growth of the Internet of Things. Our bill would begin discussions on the future of this network and ensure that the United States is adopting policies that accelerate innovation and allow it to thrive. This could have a positive effect on transportation. For instance, global supply chains represent a major opportunity to take advantage of the Internet of Things to grow exports and imports. In today's just-in-time shipping environment, time is money and efficiency is key. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, by 2045, freight volumes will increase by 45%. DOT, in its Beyond Traffic report, found that transportation delays have a high cost. For example, Nike spends an additional $4 million per week in extra inventory to compensate for shipping delays. The same report found that a week-long disruption at our nation's two largest ports, LA and Long Beach, would cost our economy as much as $150 million per day. Meanwhile, supply chains are changing rapidly in response to transportation delays and alternative options. For example, after 9 years, the $5.4 billion Panama Canal expansion is expected to open this week. Following the project's completion, the Panama Canal will be able to process ships nearly three times as large as before and will provide a greater connection between our East Coast ports and Asian export markets. A recent white paper co-authored by C.H. Robinson and the Boston Consulting Group pointed out that the canal's expansion promises to reorient the landscape of the logistics industry and alter the decision-making calculus of shippers that the canal serves. Delays in our logistics chain raise costs for shippers, infrastructure operators, carriers, and yes, consumers. By increasing connectivity and real-time data flows between stakeholders, our transportation network and its users will gain productivity. Infrastructure design, construction, maintenance, and safety will also benefit from improved data and connectivity. State and local highway officials constantly face challenges when allocating limited resources to an array of transportation projects. For example, AECOM has established a self-monitoring and analysis and reporting technology system, known as SMART, to remotely monitor bridges, dams, and other transportation assets. AECOM's SMART infrastructure seeks to use the Internet of Things to enhance the operating efficiencies of infrastructure and lengthen the life of these critical assets. Real-time monitoring represents a critical analytic tool. It can enable states and localities to expend highway dollars in a risk-based manner, thereby bolstering safety and infrastructure reliability. As part of the FAST Act, I worked with my colleagues on this committee to author a robust national freight policy that will provide states with greater resources to designate critical urban and rural corridors. Congress also expanded the objectives of the Intelligent Transportation System Program, which seeks to integrate technology, communications, and data into our transportation network to include enhancing our national freight network. Senator Booker and I have been working together to better understand the possibilities of the Internet of Things and to educate our Senate colleagues on them. I'm pleased that we have an exceptional group of stakeholders appearing before this subcommittee today. We're fortunate to have officials who are developing policy at the federal and local levels, and I'm eager to hear how private sector stakeholders are utilizing the Internet, data, and technology to manage infrastructure projects and advance freight and passenger transportation networks. I would now like to invite my friend, Senator Cory Booker, our ranking member, for any comments he may have.
Thank you very much, Chairwoman Fisher. First of all, I'm going to submit my formal opening remarks to the record. I'm kind of geeking out about this meeting, and I think this is tremendous that you all are here. There's a lot going on in Washington today, some of it laced with lots of partisanship. But this hearing right now with my partner on a lot of things, we have found more than I could have imagined. The chairwoman and I have found a lot of things to work on that are really forward-facing, trying to make not only government more efficient and effective, but really try to echo what was bipartisan work of the past. There was a great Republican president named Eisenhower who understood to help private sector flourish, there has to be creative public-private partnerships. And the one of the great ways to create connectivity of the past was just building roads and bridges to help connect our country. Well, now we're in an entirely different era. Things that I couldn't have even imagined when I saw my father bring home the first VCR I had ever seen and plug it in my house. Now we have more connected devices on the planet Earth than there are people, and we are in the stone age of the Internet of Things. And what excites me is that I have a partner to my right here who understands that if we in government don't get our act together, we're going to miss out on not only trying to help the private sector flourish in this area, but frankly, we are going to drag down the private sector because we're going to have agencies within the government that are working in silos and are tripping up and undermining innovations. And so I'm extraordinarily excited about this panel because you all are on the cutting edge of what is a whole new world, and a world that for me as a guy who comes from an inner city and represented that as mayor, I began to see that how connectivity, innovation, technology can be a massively democratizing force that could create and expand opportunity in many ways in the same way that us building the Interstate Highway Program or, by the way, creating the Transcontinental Railroad, which engine, by the way, was built in New Jersey. So I want to get right to it. I want to thank you all for being here. And a lot of the things that you're going to say are wisdoms that we've tried to put together in the Digit Act that the senator and I have together with two of our other colleagues in a bipartisan fashion. But I just want to say welcome to Washington. This is really exciting. I don't understand why all the cameras are on the other side of the Capitol talking about some place way over on the other side of the world and that they're not some more press here focusing on this, because this is a panel that are talking about things that are going to change the life of every American in ways that that they cannot imagine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Booker. Don't you just love it when he geeks out? So, no, I am also very excited that we get started. And so with that, I would like to introduce the panel. We will begin with the Honorable Carlos Monge, the Assistant Secretary for Transportation Policy at the U.S. Department of Transportation. Welcome, sir, if you would like to give your opening statement.
Thank you. Chairman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, members of the subcommittee, thank you for inviting me here today. We're getting to a point in history where data is as important to transportation as asphalt. The Internet of Things has the potential to slash commute times, to eliminate traffic accidents, reduce CO2 emissions, and reshape communities for the better. Already, we're beginning to see major advances. Connected traffic signals that detect cars and pedestrians to improve safety and speed traffic. Wayfinding applications that let commuters pick the most convenient way to get around, and sensors that help traffic engineers fix and detect structural problems. Soon, we're going to see increased deployment of technologies that will spread out travel demand and nudge travelers to make informed choices. We're going to see revolutionized logistics that includes robotics, automation, and truck platooning. Most thrilling, automated vehicles hold a promise to dramatically reduce deadly crashes and reclaim millions of hours of lost time. The President's Council on Advisors on Science and Technology said that the time regained from not driving could be worth $1.2 trillion a year, not to mention the benefits of reclaiming land from parking spaces. While we know that this transformation will be driven by the private sector, we're doing our part at USDOT. First, by building an enabling regulatory environment. Second, by never wavering from our focus on safety, security, privacy, and equity. And third, by investing in key research and tech deployments. At Secretary Fox's direction, we are doing everything we can to remove regulatory obstacles to provide the certainty and flexibility needed to encourage innovation. For instance, NHTSA is systematically reviewing its regulatory framework, making clear to innovators how to seek redress from existing barriers, developing a framework for federal and state regulators to work together, and identifying needed new regulatory tools. Our Highways Administration is finalizing guidance to road planners to how to legally and effectively install vehicle infrastructure equipment. The Federal Transit Administration is reviewing its rules to enable transit agencies across the country to participate in the mobility on demand revolution. And as the department enters this brave new world, we're combining the tools we have with the lessons we've learned, starting with a strong partnership with industry and building on a foundation of data and transparency. We've kept a razor-sharp focus on safety, security, and privacy. We're working closely with the FTC, and we're pursuing connected vehicles in a way that protects consumers from privacy risk and protects vehicles from hacking, tampering, or tracking. We're also moving aggressively on a number of fronts to bolster cybersecurity. NHTSA has challenged the auto industry to form an information sharing and analysis center to proactively address cyber threats. We've collaborated across all corners of the federal government to give planners the ability to capture and manage big data in ways that protect the privacy and safety of users. We're also investing our dollars in a strategic way to fund foundational research, to speed promising technologies to market, and to spur the national conversation on the future of mobility. FTA's Mobility on Demand program includes an $8 million sandbox, which is going to help public transit agencies explore new ways to partner with emerging service providers, whether that be carpooling, transit on demand, or bike sharing, to provide better options to their constituents. FHWA is operating three connected vehicles pilots to speed truck movement in southern Wyoming, to improve pedestrian safety in New York City, and test mobility apps in Tampa. We've developed the Freight Advanced Traveler Information System, FRATIS, which is demonstrating how sensors and data systems can speed the transfer of cargo at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. And last week, Secretary Fox announced the winner of the Smart City Challenge, a national competition to transform one mid-sized city using advanced data and technology. Columbus, Ohio will receive $40 million from us, plus a whole lot of support from a host of partners. And the city is going to deploy electronic self-driving shuttles to connect its residents to BRT line. They're going to put sensors on their city fleet to improve safety. They're going to invest in truck platooning and make it easier for delivery vehicles to find parking on city streets. And they're integrating their transportation data with other parts of their city, particularly healthcare scheduling, to help address high rates of infant mortality. 78 cities applied. Each created a blueprint for the future of transportation on their city streets. And the biggest lesson of the Smart City Challenge is that technology deployment is not an end to itself, but rather a means to build strong communities that create opportunity for all its citizens. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the department's visions. Thanks also for this subcommittee's leadership in holding this hearing, introducing legislation to speed planning for the Internet of Things. I'm glad to answer the questions you have.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Ms. Salida Reynolds, who is the General Manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairwoman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, and thank you so much to you as well as Chairman Thune and Ranking Member Nelson for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. My name is Salida Reynolds. I'm the General Manager of the Los Angeles Department of Transportation. I'm also the President of the National Association of City Transportation Officials, or NACTO. I'd like to describe where we are, where we're going, and the challenges that we face. City of Los Angeles is investing millions of dollars into our transportation system to try and evolve our reputation as the car capital of the world into the capital of one of the most modern, sophisticated transportation systems in the world. Technology doesn't just change the outcomes in our cities, it changes us as well. And so it's important for us to stay focused on people first if we want to get to the best and brightest outcomes that are possible. If we rely solely on the private side, those benefits may only land where they benefit the wealthiest among us. Our role is to make sure that the rising tide lifts all boats. Back in 1984, Los Angeles hosted the Olympics. The hottest gadget was the Sony Discman. And we invested in an interconnected system of signals called ATSAC that relied on algorithms to move cars and people through our streets, in fact, more than any other city in the country. Today, we rely on painted signs and signals to speak to drivers. In the future, that information will go directly to the vehicles themselves. These digital interfaces between the city's infrastructure and the passengers' vehicles will improve the safe flow of people and goods, light and heavy rail, and even equestrians across the city. More than 2 million people today in Los Angeles are using apps to navigate our streets. Earlier this year, we launched a Go LA app. This app allows you to choose a cheaper, faster, greener way to get from point A to point B. We give sort of a level playing field and a mobility marketplace and let the consumer make the choice about how they want to travel around our city. The next step is to evolve that into a universal payment platform where people can actually make that choice, pay for that choice, and be on their way all in the palm of their hand. We're currently launching electric vehicle car sharing in the heart of our city. While car sharing markets have evolved in some areas, we are deliberately making this accessible to people who stand to benefit the most. We're investing public dollars and to bring in private sector investment. City government has a powerful role to play to ensure that new services are understandable, legible, and accessible. We embed the needs of older adults, people unfamiliar with smartphones, or those that don't have bank cards. We partner with community groups to help people navigate possible language and cultural barriers. We are also preparing a pilot of on-demand public transit and requesting funds to upgrade signals and streets to, for example, hold a signal at red if it detects a driver about to run the light, turn signals green for transit emergency vehicles, and alert transit operators to the right speeds to get a green wave. And we are requesting proposals to develop what we call mobility hubs throughout the city at major transit stops to bring car share, bike share, and real-time transit information to travelers. Our interest is to use technology to treat people with hospitality. We want it to be a convener and not a splitter. Older technologies are also reemerging in new and interesting ways. We're outfitting our city buses with Wi-Fi and real-time location updating and becoming safer and more convenient. Bicycles are increasingly being electrified and appified to be an easier, safer, healthier, and even more fun way to travel. Maybe most importantly, a more fun way to travel. Signals are becoming smarter to help emergency responders and transit be more efficient than ever before. I want to underscore that the technologies of today are not static, and we don't want to become too wedded to one mode or pick winners and losers or ignore the real equity issues that we face. Autonomous vehicles may reduce the number of human errors occurring, but also have the potential for increased traffic, emissions from additional driving, on-street congestion, and could be very expensive to own. Technologies such as alternative fuels and shared mobility will change the funding framework. We hope that we can work closely with our partners at USDOT to continue to have a conversation about initiative funding and direct aid to cities, about realigned and flexible funding, about requiring technology to be built into transportation at the most fundamental levels, and to pivot from expansion and to modernization and management. So fixing it first and making our infrastructure smarter rather than continuing to invest in expansion. Data sharing is key to us. Ongoing investment into mass transit like high-capacity rails, because one of the most precious resources in cities will continue to be space, and preparing our workforce. As you can see, LA is an exciting place to be right now. We know that great cities generate traffic, but traffic doesn't generate great cities. Technology has the power to help communities achieve their visions, taking back public space from congestion, traffic, and parking. I want to thank Chairwoman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, and the committee members for the opportunity to testify. Our cities are changing, perhaps nowhere as quickly as Los Angeles, and we need the federal government to work with us on funding, standardizing, and exploring the future.
Thank you very much. Next, I'm going to go to Mr. Doug Davis, who is the Senior Vice President and General Manager of Intel Corporation. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairwoman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, and Senator Ayotte. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to testify this morning. As head of Intel's IoT group, I'm responsible for the company's IoT strategy and the underlying technologies. And all of that includes transportation and automotive. Intel has been delivering integrated or embedded computing for things for over 35 years. The investment, innovations, and standard leadership we've driven during that time provide the foundational elements of that IoT strategy. Intel defines the IoT quite simply as devices which are securely connected through the network to the data center or cloud. And it's the data from these things that can be shared and analyzed to solve problems. In fact, we believe that security is the foundation of the Internet of Things. Our hardware and software are designed from the beginning to be secure. We build security into the transistors or the way that we design our chips. In addition, we build security into the layers of software in these things, as well as the way in which data is moved from those things into the cloud. So we fully realize that safety and security are essential for the promise of the Internet of Things to be fulfilled. Transportation is one of the most promising sectors in the IoT. In fact, IDC has projected that global revenue from the transportation sector will reach $325 billion just by the year 2018. By converting vast amounts of data into meaningful, actionable intelligence, the IoT will help support solutions in terms of transportation safety, efficiency, mobility, and some of the infrastructure challenges. Indeed, innovations in the transportation sector are at the heart of the global race for IoT leadership, and that race is really competitive. In addition to the U.S., we see self-driving car trials on public roads in the U.K., China, Germany, Switzerland, Japan, Sweden, South Korea, the Netherlands, and in Dubai. And that's just a handful. It's a kind of a big handful. But this is a big deal for U.S. technology leadership. Autonomous vehicles require highly advanced sensors to see the things around the car, a variety of technologies to enable collision avoidance, powerful in-vehicle computing and capabilities to calculate those vehicle trajectories, and secure, high-speed, ultra-reliable connectivity back to the advanced data centers of the cloud. These autonomous vehicles must become the ultimate learning machines. They're going to need to be able to make smarter and safer decisions than even the most skilled human driver. In fact, cars will become known as data centers on wheels. And in order for this to occur, these autonomous and 5G technologies will evolve at the pace of innovation because they're going to have vast global industry support and rapid marketplace adoption. Autonomous vehicles will also improve our efficiency and productivity, as I think has already been mentioned a few times. The average American commuter spends 38 hours per year stuck in traffic, which collectively costs the U.S. economy about $121 billion per year in just wasted time and fuel. The U.S. freight transportation industry alone could save $168 billion per year in fuel reduction, not to mention the benefit in reducing harmful emissions. For the U.S. to lead the world in IoT transportation and capture these vast economic and societal benefits that a modernized transportation infrastructure, autonomous vehicles, and 5G connectivity will deliver, Intel recommends that policymakers collaborate with the high-tech and transportation industries to develop an ambitious national IoT transportation strategy based on five principles. Number one, prioritize safety to reduce the number and severity of crashes. Number two, prioritize security from the outset. Three, promote technology neutrality by relying on marketplace innovation and competition. Encourage open global standards based on transportation platforms to enable a commercialization path that is scalable, interoperable, and reusable across deployments. And then finally, number five, invest in public-private partnerships. That will help launch and scale future-looking transportation test beds, especially in the areas like 5G. To develop trusted data and secure computing, machine learning, open standards, and of course, security. So I want to thank you for this opportunity to share Intel's policy recommendations for a U.S. IoT transportation leadership. And I look forward to questions a bit later.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Dr. Robert Edelstein, Senior Vice President of AECOM. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, members of the subcommittee, on behalf of AECOM, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the advancement of new technologies to enhance our transportation and infrastructure across the country. AECOM is a Fortune 500 firm where we integrate design, build, operations, maintenance, as well as finance of infrastructure programs. According to Engineering News Record, we rank number one in transportation as well as other market sectors. Over the years, we've seen transportation management centers, or TMCs, evolve from becoming single-dimensional to multi-dimensional, multimodal, and multi-jurisdictional. And we look at the next wave as being incorporating predictive algorithms and automated decision support systems so we could stay ahead of congestion rather than reacting to it. AECOM is a global leader in TMCs. Our forte is really in the area of operations, where we operated over 40 facilities throughout the United States. In Florida and California, we developed the dynamic pricing software to support the managed lane systems. In Virginia, we've operated the reversible roadway systems. In New Jersey, we work with IBM in developing the next generation of active advanced traffic management system software, positioning themselves to incorporate the predictive algorithms and decision support systems in the future. In Michigan, we operate four TMCs, and that's really the hotbed of all the connected vehicle test beds as well as research, as well as Missouri, where we're operating the Gateway TMC, which will be accommodating the new innovations of the Road to Tomorrow program in the near future. The pace of change in this area really creates a critical need for extensive technology partnerships. Strong and adaptive technology partnerships allow communities to build upon the lessons learned from previous efforts across the country. AECOM has collaborated with firms like Xerox, where we developed the dynamic pricing software, with IBM, and working on smart city projects over in India, as well as the work that we've done in New Jersey. Next month, we were selected and we'll be starting work with the Colorado Department of Transportation on the RoadX program. We've also been supporting the Missouri DOT on their Road to Tomorrow program and coming up with new technology partnerships and new innovations. The Internet of Things provide endless opportunities for TMCs to grow. As no one owns the Internet, nor the controls or the information that's transmitted across it, the same can be said about the Internet of Things. There are about 75 million servers that operate the global Internet. There's 1.2 billion cars on our roadway systems throughout the world, more than 20% here in the United States. But cars are inefficient. They're parked 95% of the time. Our transportation systems outside the peak hours and the middays are significantly underutilized. So there's a reason why the leading global Internet companies are looking at connected and autonomous vehicles, as they understand the issues are similar to the decentralization that created the Internet many decades ago. IoT approaches will allow people and cargo to be transported more efficiently across multimodal transportation networks at designated pickup and drop-off times. This will enable the balancing of real-time travel time. This will enable the balancing of transportation supply and demand in real time and allow the user, the end user, to optimize their trips based on what's right for them in terms of the modes that they use, the schedules, and the routes. In recent years, there's been several innovations that have been incorporated into our transportation systems, smart motorways, data management systems, integrated corridor management, and now most of the attention is being focused in on the connected and autonomous vehicles. I'd like to leave with you my vision of the future for the TMC of the future, at least in my perspective. The TMC of the present continues to focus in on traffic operations and safety, and rightfully so, while the TMC of the future will start accommodating these next-generation ITS strategies, managed lanes, active traffic management, et cetera. The Internet of Things will start to glue both transportation and non-transportation functions together. While this integration may be virtual, or it may be a co-location of operations staff, and there's some advantages and disadvantages to both approach. The integration has the potential to open up new areas to apply the IoT and big data to operate our systems more efficiently. So I'd ask you that you consider the TMC of the future when we start building our smart cities. And my testimony that I'm submitting for the record has included a number of policy recommendations that I'd like you to consider as you deal with these issues in the future. So on behalf of AECOM, I'd like to thank you for receiving my testimony and look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. And next, Mr. Jordan Cass, the President of Managed Services at C.H. Robinson. Welcome.
Chairman Fisher, Ranking Member Booker, and members of the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify at today's hearing. As one of the nation's largest third-party logistics providers, C.H. Robinson has a unique view of how goods and commerce flow from manufacturer to consumer. My name is Jordan Cass, and I am President of Managed Services for C.H. Robinson. I joined Robinson in 1999 by way of an acquisition. At that time, I created a startup within Robinson trying to figure out how to leverage internet technology within the supply chain. Today, that startup business manages over $3 billion of logistics spend in 170 different countries on behalf of our customers. Our mission is to develop innovative technology platforms paired with managed services that help our customers connect, automate, and optimize their supply chains. C.H. Robinson has over 150 offices around the world networked through our common proprietary platform called Navisphere, which provides our employees, our customers, and our carriers visibility to freight shipments around the country and globe. Today, we are also speaking on behalf of the Transportation Intermediaries Association, which represents 1,500 3PLs of all sizes. We do not own any commercial trucks ourselves, but build technology platforms and logistics services that streamline complex transportation management on behalf of our customers. Our diverse carrier base includes motor carriers, railroads, air freight, and ocean carriers. The division of Robinson that I lead works with some of the largest companies in the world, and this platform that we've developed serves as the platform these companies use to gain visibility and control over our supply chain. Our customers include companies like Microsoft, Delphi Automotive, and Ocean Spray. A major component of our value proposition is routing massive amounts of information and money quickly and accurately around the world. This is enabled by technology and automation, from the truck driver using our cell phone app to find available loads, to the customer who needs to find desired landed costs tracked to the item level. Data and the Internet of Things is driving change in our business. We are rapidly expanding these tools and information available to all trading partners across the supply chain. For example, a single truck owner-operator uses our app to check in, like a GPS-equipped truck, and similarly, a global shipper can view tracking updates anywhere in the world via PC, smartphone, or tablet. Businesses today are part of a global cross-functional teams of coordinating production, customer service, sales, finance, and transportation. They work together toward an end goal of customer experience and agile market response. As Congress considers the implications in an increasingly connected world has on policy, we see things differently from a supply chain and flow of goods viewpoint. Today, others have discussed privacy and IT infrastructure. However, we think that Congress also needs to look at practical issues regarding freight movement brought about by the Internet of Things. We fully understand that the subcommittee does not have jurisdiction over all the issues I will mention. However, the Internet of Things has forced us to look holistically with our customers at end-to-end supply chain practices. We want to reiterate that the greatest challenge Congress and subcommittees may have with the Internet of Things is that it will force the government to work across silos or be left behind by more agile governments. The following are our recommendations. First, tax rates. Many of the companies leading the revolution around the Internet of Things are operating with a tax code designed for the 1980s. For example, C.H. Robinson is a service company with no assets, and we pay a full U.S. corporate tax of 35%. Even though we are 208 on the Fortune 500, we are a Fortune 100 corporate taxpayer. If Congress wishes to incubate globally leading companies, a corporate tax form is a prerequisite. World-class customs agency. We see the U.S. customs clearance process as a significant risk to supply chains. When the ACE system goes down for 2 hours during produce season in San Diego, it impacts supply chains across the nation. Congress needs to make sure our U.S. Customs Agency provides a world-class service and works well with agencies to ensure safe and efficient movement of goods. Increasing resources for cargo theft deterrence. Cargo thieves are using the Internet to target specific freight. Law enforcement is challenged to investigate cargo thefts and victims in many locations. A stolen load of almonds may originate in California, be stolen in Nevada on a truck based out of Missouri. We recommend increasing penalties for cargo theft and providing law enforcement resources to fund cargo theft specific units. land use and planning around the rise of megacities. Increasingly, freight moves between a handful of global cities see huge population and density growth, including Chicago, Houston, New York, and LA. Issues of land use, truck parking, congestion, vehicle size, and operating hours all interact with the growth of things and the speed of change of delivery direct to the consumer. Thank you for the opportunity to provide insight into how the Internet of Things is impacting supply chains. We look forward to working with the committee on a policy that allows U.S. logistics companies to continue leading the world.
Thank you very much to the entire panel. We will begin our first round of questions, 5 minutes for each member. I'd like to start with one issue that I've been concerned about, and that's the creation of these regulatory silos. And I'm worried about the lack of coordination between government agencies where we may see duplication take place and cross-purposes happen on this with regulations. When my ranking member and I and two other senators introduced the Digit Act, one thing we wanted to be sure to do was have a working group created, and we did that. And that's a working group with government and also private stakeholders. And we want to make sure that we can look at streamlining and having complementary regulations between agencies when we address the Internet of Things. So I would like to ask all the members of the panel, what do you believe is causing these regulatory silos, and what do you think is the best way that we can encourage cooperation among agencies in order to look at how best to allow that innovation and creativity to continue to take place with the Internet of Things? Who would like to start? Yes, Doctor.
I think the Departments of Transportation, including the U.S. Department of Transportation, has already taken that first step. And the first step is really Transportation Systems Management and Operations, or TSMNO. And the way I look at it, with TSMNO and IoT, when those two worlds collide, it's going to really unleash unlimited potential. What Transportation Systems Management and Operations is focused on is creating operational integration between the various modal partners, whether it be buses, trains, toll roads, free roads, freeways, or arterial operations. It's also aligned with performance metrics, so everybody has some skin in the game with regard to defining what those performance metrics, tracking those performance metrics, and making sure that we're making certain improvements that's noticeable by the end user, which is the traveler. So, again, it's not a regulatory issue, but it's more of an operational issue. And I think that is starting to come together rather quickly in many states throughout the country.
Mr. Davis.
Chairwoman Fisher, I think you're asking a great question. And let me touch on a couple things. First, I want to applaud the work that has been done on the Digit Act and the goals that's trying to achieve. I think that's a very important direction for us to be taking with regards to Internet of Things. You asked an interesting question about the history in terms of why we have these silos. And I think it's really been because of the optimization that's been needed in those various different industries, right? We want to optimize what's happening in shipping, optimize what's happening in retail, in the network infrastructure. So I think that's been a very natural kind of evolution. But as we think forward around the Internet of Things, that'll be one of our challenges to scale is to have these local optimizations. Because we're seeing that these technologies needed to create the connectivity between things and the data center or cloud will need to become more and more common. And that's why we're advocating the implementation of open platforms, right, to allow for much greater flexibility to break down some of those silos. That will be essential for the Internet of Things to be able to scale. We look at 5G technologies. We look at what we're trying to accomplish across the industries with regards to security. These things are going to have to become much more open. They're going to have to be driven by public-private partnerships to define the right capabilities. That's what's going to enable scalability as we go forward in the Internet of Things.
Do you think we're going to have to see a collision take place before we will have that openness, or will we be proactive in trying to head it off before we get there?
Well, obviously, I'm hoping that we can be proactive and avoid a collision. But I think that's really why it's important to think about this globally and think about what's happening in other parts of the world and have that national IoT strategy for the U.S. to really be in a leadership position to help shape how that evolves. And I think as far as we, you know, we can think ahead and be proactive, that'll avoid that ultimate collision.
Thank you. I'm running out of time, but if the other three witnesses can give me a short answer. Yes.
Senator, your question is exactly right, and it's something that we've been driven to do by the White House has directed us. We're working very closely with the Federal Trade Commission when it comes to privacy. They're in charge, but we have a huge stake in it, and we're working very closely with them. The National NTIA on issues of cybersecurity, broadband access, and the FCC when it comes to spectrum. But we're not only reaching across the federal government, but also down into the states as well. And as NHTSA is establishing their regulatory framework, we're working very closely with the states because what you don't want to have is a patchwork.
Okay. Ms. Reynolds, did you have a comment?
I appreciate the question, and obviously government silos are nothing new. They're something that we've struggled with for quite a long time. I think that what it really comes down to is the way that we measure success is often at odds. And so Dr. Edelstein's point about having a shared performance metric and hearing a clear signal, which we've heard from USDOT and the federal government, that the road to funding is paved with partnerships, and that if you want to be at the table, you need to bring private partners along with you, you need to bring the state, you need to bring your region, are really bringing up some very uncomfortable sacred cows that we have to wrestle with. So I think that that's one of the major ways that there's been kind of a happily forced arranged marriage among different sectors of the public and private side.
And Mr. Cash, shortly, if you could condense, I
very
apologize.
Quickly. My expertise is supply chain and technology. It's not government.
You're the best one to answer the question.
having said that, as I said in my testimony, I think these walls need to be broken down. If we don't do this, what's going to happen is there are two supply chains at work. There's a physical one and a virtual one. The virtual supply chain is about moving information and money. That, in the Internet of Things, that's going to be visible. If we don't fix this problem, all of the problems that exist today, the nodes, the failure modes, those are going to be exposed on a massive scale. So we've got to get out in front of this and get out in front of it quickly.
Thank you very much. Senator Booker.
Thank you very much. So when I was mayor of my city, I discovered that if just getting my accountability from my team members, that if I started encouraging constituents to tweet at me problems, that I would begin to find out about things, and it worked better than I knew. I could find out about potholes before my road engineers. I could find out about traffic lights out. I started crowdsourcing what was going wrong in the city. And obviously, that's a very rudimentary, inefficient way. When you can set up cities like Los Angeles, where you could have sensors detecting problems and funneling information at the speed of light. So the Smart Cities initiatives, to me, is as a former mayor, is really exciting. And would you please give Mayor Garcetti my best when you get back to Los Angeles? I studied with him in Oxford. He still owes me £10, which at this point is only worth like 50 cents, given where the pound is going. But tell him I want my money. Would you tell me what kind of challenges you guys are facing in implementing what is a cutting-edge vision to try to make Los Angeles? What are some of the biggest obstacles to being a smart city that you're finding?
So thank you for the question, and I'll say it's two things. One, fundamentally, public and private side are going to have to get way outside of our comfort zones in order to achieve the kind of partnership that we need. Our procurement practices, for example, I would say are probably the single biggest hurdle to really getting public partners to the table. As soon as it takes us, 18 or 24 months to write a request for proposals and bring a vendor on board, the technology has passed us by. Federal Transit Administration and others have done a really good job signaling that they're willing to waive some of the federal procurement requirements to allow cities to have access to these funds. I would identify that. Second, I would say that, the role of government is that we can, our most rudimentary tool is that we can say no. And I think that oftentimes we find ourselves in that position when we are encountering the sort of disruption or introduction of new technologies in transportation in our cities. We need to pivot to using one of the other sort of lesser used powers of government, which is to bring people together, to convene, possibly to regulate, and to make sure that, you know, the price of entry into our cities is that you have to serve them equitably. I'll just give one example. We recently executed, Mayor Garcetti executed a data sharing agreement with Waze. One in four drivers in the city of Los Angeles is using Waze to get around our city with positive and potentially negative impacts. The way we've been using it is bringing Waze data into our ATSAC system, fusing the data streams that we have to make our system even smarter. We save Los Angeles drivers over 40 hours every year because we have a smart transportation signal system. That is just the tip of the iceberg, and it points to the other big challenge, which is that we don't have the skill sets inside government. I don't have a civil service classification for data scientist in the city of Los Angeles. And we desperately need those kinds of skill sets and capacity building inside government so that we can really come to the table as an equal partner.
No, I appreciate that. And that's what the White House is finding out with their innovation team. Procurement is one of the biggest problems we have. The procurement processes are set up for dealing with big, massive companies, not the small innovators that are at the cutting edge. I appreciate that. And in 1 minute and 30 seconds I have left, Mr. Cass, Mr. Davis, I get very annoyed when I watch other countries who are beginning to out-innovate us. Should be the innovation capital of the globe. I'm a competitive guy. I want us to be number one. But when I see government regulations choking things, like the drone industry, for example, and watching innovation in that sector go over to Europe as opposed to here, because we haven't created an environment that's best for that. So to the two men who are in the private sector, could you guys just tell me what are other countries doing better than us that we should be doing better than them?
So let's start. I think it's a great point. And that's one of the reasons that we've been advocating for public-private partnerships, right, is to be able to bring private industry alongside what's happening from a regulatory standpoint, as well as what's happening in areas like academia, right, to be able to provide those kinds of partnerships to go off and define what needs to happen. Again, the emphasis is on what, as opposed to the very specific how of the implementation. That's what we often find ends up happening when we try to put regulation in place too early, as the technology is still rapidly evolving. We should agree on what we're trying to accomplish as opposed to the very specific implementation. And that's one of the things that we find as we look at what's happening globally is that opportunity to innovate much more openly.
Jordan, why don't you hold on, because I want to be respectful to Senator Cantwell. She's a dear friend, and I don't want to make her angry. and I'll let her go. We'll come around to another round.
Yeah, no problem.
Says that's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the panelists. Is it Monche?
Monet.
Thank you so much for your work. I wanted to talk to you and to Mr. Davis about freight, because this is something that we want to be strategic about in the United States, the opportunity to ship more goods to markets overseas from the U.S., very important economic strategy for us, but it has to move in a timely fashion, and obviously there's lots of challenges. So how is the Department of Transportation, you know, we've had this now strategic freight plan. How are you working with the Internet of Things? We had, I think it was one of the California ports here last year, and they talked about the efficiencies that you can roll out at our ports by having this kind of data and information on cargo movements and on trucks.
Yes, ma'am. Well, thank you for the question. And freight is the lifeblood of our economy, and this Congress has been on the record in really pushing us as a department to come up with a strategic plan to work with states. In terms of the Internet of Things, it has the tremendous potential. We know we're going to see 45% more freight over the next 30 years on our roads, on our ports, and across our seaways. Some of the things we're doing include testing and proving the quality of the technology called Freightus, which we're implementing at the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, and it's helping drayage operators get cargo off of ships and to where they need to go a lot quicker. We've got a connected vehicle pilot in Wyoming that's really focused on speeding truck traffic along Interstate 80, which has major weather events. And so how are we using technology to move that forward? As part of our Smart City Challenge, we actually got a lot of really neat examples of communities that are trying to figure this out for themselves. Columbus is proposing, and they won, so they're going to be able to implement the ability to practice truck platooning along smart corridors, better ways to do urban parking. One of the neater ideas that came is from Austin, which is actually looking at shared urban delivery lockers. So people, as they get off the bus, will be able to pick up their groceries or a package, and they don't have to make an extra trip to get there. So we're doing a lot of foundational research in the maritime area. We know that this is a tremendous area of opportunity, and that we need to be partners in that process.
Well, Mr. Davis, I think the average tractor trailer gets something like 6 miles per gallon. So anything we can do to increase the fuel efficiency there is going to be a huge savings. And I know that, again, DOT has a super truck. Is that what you were referring to, the super truck program? I didn't get the acronym you used for your...
Freitas is what I refer to.
How do you spell that?
F-R-A-T-I-S.
Okay. Well, I know you also have a super truck program, and it's focused on getting more like 9, you know, almost 10 miles per gallon. So how do you think that some of these tools could be used to help the transportation sector on timing on deliveries?
I think we've seen some really exciting technologies in their early stages. I think Mr. Monhey talked about a couple. Mr. Cass even described a few, which is to be able to put technologies in trucks that enable us to understand how they're being driven, and to be able to provide feedback to the driver about how he or she can drive more efficiently. We've seen this implemented in a couple of large trucking firms already, and they see some of those pretty impressive improvements in fuel efficiency. I think that's one. We're seeing technologies evolve that allow us to be able to very cost-effectively identify the location and the conditions of high-value freight so that we know where it is, we know what kind of conditions it's being subjected to. And then to be able to use autonomous technologies, right, to be able to identify maybe containers that are coming on in on a ship with where trucks are located, to be able to synchronize the way they're offloaded to take advantage of the trucks or the traffic conditions to move that material effectively. So we're seeing some very interesting early stage technologies. The challenge is how we make that more and more common across all of those applications to enable it to scale.
Well, I think we learned in air transportation now that there's a cell lot and everybody hangs out in the cell lot. I think that that statistic is quite impressive, a 45% increase in freight traffic. I mean, we want the United States to make things, we want to sell things, we want to move them, but the congestion level at the ports is so great. So a strategy that could more ease that traffic in there and move it in a more systematic way would be huge savings and would help us with our competitiveness in manufacturing. So I hope that we'll stick with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. The Internet of Things leads also to the Internet of Threats, because obviously every device that has the Internet built into it then becomes subject to hacking. That's just the bottom line. So you have to basically deal with the digital tale of two technologies. You know, it's the best of technologies, it's the worst of technologies simultaneously. So if you don't deal with the threats, then all you are doing is ignoring the inevitable problems that are going to be created. So really today's new cars are just computers on wheels. That's all they really have become, and that's why in 2013, and again last year, Senator Blumenthal and I asked 20 automakers what they are doing to protect our computers on wheels. And here's what we learned. Thieves no longer need a crowbar to break into your car. They just need an iPhone. Last year, we witnessed firsthand how easily cars can be hacked. We watched as hackers remotely took control of the brakes, the steering, and acceleration of a Jeep Cherokee. Chrysler had to recall 1.4 million vehicles to fix this cybersecurity problem. But in this new Internet of Things era, cybersecurity just cannot be an afterthought. Rather than addressing cybersecurity problems after a hack has occurred, we have to ensure robust cybersecurity protections are built in to these technologies right from the beginning. And That means that we need enforceable rules of the road to protect driver privacy and security. And that's why I introduced legislation with Senator Blumenthal, the Security and Privacy in Your Car Act, or SPY Car Act, that directs the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Federal Trade Commission to establish federal standards to secure our cars and protect our drivers. So for all of the panelists, please answer yes or no. Do you believe that cars should have mandatory cybersecurity standards, including hacking protections that protect all access points in a car, data security measures that prevent unwanted access to all collected information, and hacking mitigation technologies that can detect, report, and stop hacking attempts in real time? Dr. Edelstein.
Definitely yes.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Davis.
Definitely yes. The one thing I would add is I think it's important to define what we need to accomplish to address the things that you described, but also to allow technology to evolve quickly.
But if it evolves and it's still not installed, we should mandate that it's installed.
We should define requirements to ensure these things are secure.
Mr. Cass.
Yes, we need the appropriate controls, but I agree we need to do it in a very balanced way that doesn't kill innovation. Innovation's like a whack-a-mole, right? You try to beat it down, it's just going to pop up someplace else. So we really need a mechanism of ensuring that if we're going to put controls in place, that it's not offsetting the innovation that's about to take place, but rather helping it and making sure it thrives. Right.
But haven't you found over the years, Mr. Cass, that if people can get away without building in the protections against hacking or privacy, that they just do it to save money?
People never cease to amaze me.
Thank you so much. So it's not just whack-a-mole, it's just whack-a-bad person.
Well, no, I was speaking of innovation. We can't policy our way out of it. It's that someone is going to innovate, and it needs to be us.
Right, we have to do
it. We need to lead with it.
But at the same time, we then have to tell people who don't want to install the safety protections that they have to do it.
Fair enough.
Okay, thank you. That's all I'm really saying. And Ms. Reynolds?
I think the answer is certainly yes, and I'll add that there's a role for smart infrastructure as well. One of the few benefits to having started our connected signal system in the 80s is that it's all hard fiber and it's virtually unhackable. There will be a role for infrastructure to manage not just the hacking, but the 12 or 20 different vehicle software technologies that are out there.
But again, I didn't get the correct answer from the auto manufacturers. Thank you so much. I mean, seatbelts good, but not just yet. You know, airbags good, but not just yet. Okay, we just want the technology to evolve a little bit more. So when, oh Lord, will you put those seatbelts, those airbags, those hacking protections in? Mr. Monge.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you for your leadership on this issue. Cybersecurity is going to be a continuous challenge for the rest of the century, and there's substantial motivation on our part to get it right on behalf of safety, certainly from the manufacturers. NHTSA is doing everything we can. We have established standards, a security credential management system for V2V technology to ensure that those packets of information can be shared safely. We're going to continue to work with industry, continue to work with experts to make sure we continue to fight this threat.
And Dr. Edelstein, if I have just one more minute, please. Thank you. And do you believe also that we should make owners explicitly aware of collection, transmission, retention, and use of driving data and provide owners the right to say no to data collection and retention without losing access to key navigation or other features?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Davis?
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Cass?
Yes, and just generally speaking, with all of the information that's going to be available, this concept of opting out, I think, is important.
Excellent. Thank you. Ms. Reynolds?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, sir. It's very important to only collect the information you need and make sure consumers know what they're sharing.
Thank you. So I think that's a great balance here. It's not all good. Like any other technology, there's the bad as well. And we just have to make sure that we build in the protections at the same time that we build in the opportunities. And if we do that, then I think we've discharged our responsibility as policymakers. I thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Ranking Member, for this very important hearing.
Thank you, Senator Markey. Dr. Edelstein, in your written testimony, you discussed several innovative transportation projects that you're currently working on. For example, you mentioned that AECOM employs sensors to monitor the Brooklyn Bridge for cracks and also for temperature fluctuation. What's the impact of real-time data monitoring on our nation's critical transportation infrastructure assets, especially as it relates to public spending on maintenance?
We're not monitoring the Brooklyn Bridge. That was a case example that other people are doing, but it has nothing to do with AECOM. I just wanted to get that out. Again, in my vision for the control centers of the future, I really see it getting into not only moving people and cargo more efficiently, but also asset management in real time. This way, we could put sensors out on our bridges, and we could monitor smart buildings with regard to energy systems. We could monitor, we could put sensors out on our water systems to see if there's any potential leaks in the pipes that will cause inefficiency. So what I'm looking at is a control center. Again, it could be a virtual control center. It doesn't have to be a one, you know, massive building. A control center that would monitor all of the assets that the agencies own, operate, and maintain. And I think by doing that, you'll get more efficiencies, and I think it'll dovetail very nicely with the smart city concept. With the smart city concept, I think the platforms that they'll be using allows everything to be interconnected, but there needs to be something there, a control center that monitors all these assets in real time to gain more efficiencies of the systems.
And as you have this control center that's monitoring in a, I would assume, a more timely and also a more accurate manner, how do you see that affecting safety in the future and also looking at the reliability of our infrastructure?
Right, right.
Using the example of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Okay. Well, with regard to safety, if it was the Brooklyn Bridge and you had another incident with regard to I-35, the bridge up in Minnesota, hopefully by having the sensors out on the bridge, we could be more proactive in detecting if there is something wrong with the bridge ahead of time, so we could make some corrections to it before you have a catastrophe, something like that. In terms of reliability and other forms of safety, the traffic management centers are already doing that. They're able to detect an incident or a lane closure or an accident in a lot faster than the way that we used to do it without the technologies embedded into the systems. For example, we've been working on a project down in Miami for about the last 10 years, operating their control center. When we first started, it took about 50 minutes or so to clear a lane blockage incident. Now it's about half that time. That half the time translates into safety benefits as well as travel time reliability. In terms of safety benefits, for every minute that we save in a lane blocking event and clearing that lane that much faster, translates to nearly 3% of a probability of a secondary accident happening. So if you take a 15-minute lane blocking event, if you're taking a lane blocking event and you could clear it 15 minutes faster, you're talking about improving the probability that you won't have a secondary accident by about 40%. And in terms of travel time reliability, the formula is, I think for every minute that you save, it translates to 4 minutes of savings. So again, a 15-minute clearance improvement would translate to about an hour backup delay that you're saving. So I think it all ties together, whether you're managing assets or you're managing traffic as well as safety.
Do you see cities and states and also private businesses stepping forward and willing to embrace these new technologies? Is there enthusiasm on their part, or is it balanced with reality and looking at the cost?
It's more so the latter. There's definitely enthusiasm, no doubt about it. But many cities are struggling, just paying the day-to-day bills. They have to deal with potholes. They have to deal with physical safety improvements as well as infrastructure improvements that may increase capacity in some of their roadway systems. technology is nice. They're looking at those. They're looking at that as the long-term solution, but balancing the firefighting issues that they deal with on a day-to-day basis and the budget and the evolution of technology as it comes online, it's pretty tricky. But I would have to say that most cities and states, they are very enthusiastic about technology innovations. But again, it's just so much money to go around.
Thank you very much. Senator Booker.
Chair Fisher, Senator Klobuchar has asked if she can go next. She has a committee to return to.
Senator Klobuchar. Thank you very much. I'm the ranking member on this hearing we're having on a bill that we passed last year on sex trafficking. But I want to thank you all for coming. I especially want to thank Mr. Cass, who represents here C.H. Robinson, which is headquartered in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, with his 22 years of experience in freight logistics. As you may know, C.H. Robinson has evolved from a wholesale produce brokerage house to a major third-party logistics provider, largest network of motor carrier capacity in North America, gross revenues of $13.5 billion in 2015, and one of 17 Fortune 500 companies based in my state. So we're proud of the work that they do and what they can bring to this discussion. Mr. Cass, could you talk about how you've leveraged the Internet of Things at your company to increase the efficiency of multimodal shipments?
Sure. When you think about our company, its focus is on developing technology platforms and services to connect, automate, and optimize supply chains. What the Internet of Things has done is allowed us to create algorithms that quickly and easily select the most optimal mode of transportation. Many shippers today can't respond in the time. They don't have the resources. They may not even have the expertise to take a look at what their freight network looks like in real time and frankly shift from a truckload shipment to an intermodal shipment, which poses significant advantages. The intermodal obviously is going to reduce the carbon footprint. It's going to lower the overall cost, and it's going to take capacity off the road, and I think put it in a safer environment.
Very good. Thank you very much. One of the things that we've learned in our state, which I guess we share with all three members that are here today, New Jersey, Nebraska, and Wisconsin, is that you can have all the networks you want for transportation, but if you have snow and the trucks can't move, then we have a problem, or the trains can't go. I know the Minnesota Department of Transportation has applied for a grant through the U.S. Department of Transportation's Advanced Transportation and Congestion Management Technologies Deployment Program. That's quite a mouthful. That's used to improve the effectiveness of snow plows. It's no small thing in our state. We're pretty proud of how quickly we clear out the roads, but technology can always make us better. Let's just say it works a lot better here. Works a lot better in Minnesota than Washington, D.C. Dr. Edelstein, how will the new communications opportunities from the Internet of Things improve public safety and the delivery of government services with things like snow plowing?
Well, if you look at it from, let's start with the end user. The end user wants their street snow plowed within a certain time frame, or they want to know at least when their street is going to be plowed. By having the Internet of Things, this could provide the communication between the individual and the agency responsible for the plowing. So you're opening up the communications. Also, you're opening up the potential to optimize where you have the snow plows, which roads that deserve the highest priority, and you can monitor that in real time. So if you have to do multiple runs of a street because the snow is still coming down, again, you have the potential of using the IoT and big data to optimize the routing of the snow plows, assuming that they have automated vehicle location devices on them mm-hmm. or some type of sensors.
No, I think that's just a great example because I really am stunned by how long it takes. My daughter went from the public schools of Minnesota where she'd had no snow days for 7 years. And then when she got to the Arlington Public Schools, which were very good, she had 2 weeks off in her first year. So, I do think that there's got to be a better way to do that. And I understand that areas that have more snow are more affected by it. I guess my last question is just along those same lines. The need to have broadband installation and fast speed broadband to make this work. One of the bills that we have in the Mobile Now Act would actually require focused more on dig once, which is to try to, when you have highway projects, that you try to put the internet in at the same time to make it more efficient. And obviously many of us on this committee are working on expanding access for broadband in rural areas as well. So any comments you have about the need to have Wi-Fi to make all this work?
That's really outside my expertise, so I'll take a pass on that.
Well, could you assume you need Wi-Fi if we're going to have these things on snowplows? Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Just want to finish up on the question I was in before about what other countries are doing that's better than the United States. What can we be learning so we can, again, continue to be the global exporter of innovation on the planet Earth? So, Mr. Davis, you were sort of finishing your answer. I didn't know if you wanted to add any more before I go to Mr. Cass or Dr. Edelstein.
Yeah, I'll just add on one example. You know, a great technology enabler for the Internet of Things is going to be 5G wireless infrastructure. And we see a number of countries moving very quickly there, right, creating test beds, creating opportunities to do trials, right? We'll see it not only in fixed infrastructure that needs to be able to communicate back to a data center cloud, but even mobile infrastructure. We see in Germany, they're running trials now on the Autobahn to learn how to maintain high data rate connectivity when a car is moving very fast down the freeway. We see around the Winter Olympics, Summer Olympics coming up in the future in South Korea and Japan, right, doing, again, early pilots, early test beds. I think the more that we can do things to foster those.
But why aren't we doing those here? And by the way, with 5G, is some of the innovations because you have a more predictable, understandable marketplace for innovation and patents and the like over in Europe now than you necessarily do here? Is that some of the reason why they?
I think it's much more about just creating the opportunity, right? You know, we see these big events like the Winter Olympics or the Summer Olympics, and that becomes kind of a vocal point for that country to say, hey, let's go put a lot of resources in.
And so we're not maybe government not creating sandboxes where people can.
I think we want to look for more test beds. We want to look for opportunities where we can say, hey, let's go all in. Let's create a solution to really kind of force the technology to get deployed for us to understand where we need to do more optimization. I think it's looking for those kinds of opportunities.
Okay, thank you. And Jordan, Mr. Cass, first of all, I want to just echo, because you put in your comments, and it's something that I feel very strongly about, that we have a ridiculously bad tax environment to incentivize companies here. And I see it in biotech with a lot of New Jersey firms inverting now because of the bad environment. So please don't think that I haven't gotten that point, and don't say basically hallelujah, amen, and join your chorus of conviction to change that. But what else are other countries doing besides creating a better tax environment?
Well, firstly, thank you for reading my mind. I appreciate that. It was going to be the way I answered the question. But secondarily, when I look at our global base of talent and the diversity of it, there's something that's happened here where we're just not developing math students the way that other countries are. And I think that's core to engineering, and it's core to where the Internet of Things is going. And don't get me wrong, we've got talent, but we're not developing it at the speed and the pace that some of these other countries.
No, we've fallen from number one in the country for graduate engineers, math majors. Now we're out of in the top 10. Other countries are realizing that this new economy is going to necessitate having STEM folks, and America's falling behind.
Yeah, and then I would add to it, the ones that we do, there is a male bias to it, and we need to figure out how to get that neutralized as well. So I would point you in the direction of how we get that fixed.
Great. Dr. Edelstein, do you have anything to add about, especially port efficiency is something even the Secretary of Transportation and I have talked about how in the Northeast People are choosing to use Canadian ports because they're more efficient than ours are. Is there anything that other countries are doing in terms of the Internet of Things for freight logistics that we could be learning from here and catching up on?
Other countries, freight.
I'll tell you what, Dr. Nussle, let me move to my last question and try to get it in 10 seconds each. If you had a government dollar, if we were going to be investing, where would you focus your government dollar, Mr. Davis, in terms of getting the biggest return?
It would really, as I said earlier, I think creating these partnerships and these opportunities to really move technology forward between the private sector, the regulators, and academia.
Jordan?
This may surprise everybody, but it would be infrastructure.
More specific.
Specifically the road infrastructure. If I painted a picture of the United States and I showed you the traffic flows around the United States, you would see very clearly on a map where those arteries were unbelievably constricted in major cities around the world. And there's a trend of urbanization. It's clear. There were 10 megacities, so cities over 10 million in population. There were 10 megacities, I believe, 10 years ago. Now there's 23. People are moving into cities because they need access to products. And that trend is clear. If we don't fix the infrastructure, whatever we do with the Internet of Things is just going to expose the fact that we don't have the infrastructure to move the flow of goods properly.
Tax reform, infrastructure investment, I really like you, Mr. Cass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your help and your service. Because we have a vote, I'm just going to ask you one quick question. Positive train control. What can we do to achieve it more quickly and implement it around the country?
Well, I'll start. Thank you, Senator. And we've been pushing positive train control, and thank you so much for your leadership on this issue. I think we're very excited at the Department of Transportation that we've got $199 million to spend thanks to the FAST Act to help commuter rails get on board. There's still significant challenges across the rail industry to implementing this, including access to spectrum, including equipment issues. We're doing everything we can. We're working with the FCC. We're working with the Class 1s. We're working with short lines, with commuter rails. We're doing everything we can to hold their feet to the fire and to make sure we get this technology deployed quickly and safely. We know that the technology would have prevented the crash in front of in Philadelphia. The opportunities for safety are substantial, and we are dedicated to this technology.
Any other thoughts? How about sensors at rail grade crossing? These are practical rail safety measures that will save lives.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent idea. Unfortunately, it takes probably a good mile or so before the train to slow down to get to the point where that railroad crossing, where that person that might be in the railroad crossing would avoid getting hit. I live in Florida. We just had an incident like that last week where a family of four was at the railroad crossing. Three of them got out, but one of them got hit by the train. The communications needs to be obviously with the driver of the train to bring it back to a control center. Wouldn't give you enough time to react. In urban areas where you have railroad crossing space 3 or 4 per mile, it becomes a real tricky situation. Now, with the Internet of Things, this might be able to be managed a little bit more efficiently than the way we used to do it in the past. But I think there's a lot of upside potential in addressing these issues in railroad crossings.
Thank you all.
Upon receipt, the witnesses are requested to submit their written answers to the committee as soon as possible. With that, the hearing is adjourned.